Doncs bé, començarem. Les confluències artístiques en la literatura barroca. Per a mi és tot un plaer presidir sobre la primera sessió del Congrés. Les comunicacions seran dues. La primera a càrrec d'en Barry Taylor, aquí a la meva dreta, de la British Library, i que el títol és Allegorical Title Pages of the Baroque Period, o pàgines titulars al·legòriques del període barroc. I la segona, a càrrec de l'Anna Martínez de la Universitat Complutense de Madrid, de Letes del Parnaso, la poesia gràfica en l'edat moderna espanyola, inventario i paradigma. Després de cada comunicació, m'agradaria obrir la sessió durant uns 10 minuts, diguem-ne, a comentaris, preguntes i respostes, perquè veritablement tinguem un tipus de col·loqui professional. Molt bé, començarem amb Barry, Allegorical Title Pages of the Baroque Period.
Oh, thank you, Kenneth. Good afternoon, can you hear me? Good afternoon, can you hear me? Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Thank
you.
Sir.
Thank you, Kenneth. Thank you to the Academic Committee for inviting me here, and thank you for the ever essential work of the Organising Committee. I start with two examples. We look at this title page, there's no doubt that we are in 1538 or thereabouts. And there's no doubt that we are now in 1605 with a typical Baroque title pages. Allegorical figures in the middle, architecture, emblems at the bottom. I don't know who Harsdörfer was, but he's a 17th century witness who says, nowadays, there is hardly any book to be bought without a title engraving which transmits to the reader the same content, the confluence of the arts, not only with words, but with an image. And that's a good quotation. However, it may not be correct that Vital Durand, in a book on the Livre Scientifique of the 17th century, says that in that period, barely 10% of books have frontispieces, but she may be speaking only of scientific works. Such title pages are syncretic. They're international. They are trans-religious, right, between Catholic and Protestant countries, although I think the weight of these things lies with the Catholic Church. It lies often with the city of Rome, and it lies often with the Order of Jesus, Society of Jesus. They combine text and image, and they combine the large with the small. Just to distinguish frontispiece and title page, in English we tend to distinguish the title page, which has the title of the book and the imprint, from the frontispiece, which is normally makes a pair with the title page. But certain other languages don't distinguish them. The medium is normally metal engraving, often on copper, cut with the burin. Thus the engraver could achieve a greater degree of detail than was possible with a woodcut. And what I think is interesting is that work on the engraved title page could proceed apart from the printing of the book, that Pedro Perret, although I think he was probably a Frenchman, is believed to have worked on title pages for books printed in Portugal, while he himself lived in Madrid. And it's also worth saying that, as we know from the correspondence of Rubens, these engravings were expensive to make. So, what are the elements? The model for the frame is unknown, but there are many analogies with architecture. Let me see if I can make them in order of size. Architecture, altarpieces, tombs, and doors. And we can see a progression, I think. This is Jacques de Cessol, 1504. The prototype, a rectangular frame with elements which correspond to the text, because this is Cessol's, he uses the game of chess as a mirror of society. So you see Le Laboureur and such like. By Galen, 1531, it's still the same rectangular frame, but with the addition of Corinthian columns and such like, and images of his physicians, Hippocrates, Galen, and these other two chaps whose names I forget, and a scene from his life. Hippocrates, 1588, the same structure. And in 1671, the Basilica Chimica, again the same rectangular frame. Some of these scenes are historical. I mean, you saw before, scenes from the life of Hippocrates. Then come the title page. Oh dear. Well, picture. in fact, what we saw previously. The title pages, which are miniature versions of buildings. And I want to stress in this paper the question of scale. Big things made small, small things made big, with the architectural structure. And though not in this side, we will see in a moment the twisted Salomonic columns, which derive from a particular reading of the Book of Kings. I'd like to quote a poem by Cristóbal de Mesa, which I think summarises everything the 17th century thought was monumental and lasting. Pretty well every element he lists would appear again and again in our title pages. I'll only give you the beginning. Teatro, Capitolio, Coliseo, columnas, arcos, mármoles, medallas, estatuas, obeliscos y murallas, lo vencieron las obras el deseo. I won't read the list. Mesa is talking of love. He says his unhappy love will pass eventually, as all things do. But he puts it in the same category as the classical architecture, which will be destroyed eventually, but only after a very long time indeed. One aspect of the nature of the title page as a point of artistic confluence is its similarity to tombs. I think the model here is a tomb. This is Juan de Malara, 1568. This is one of my favourites, de Late. He's writing about the Dutch Empire in Brazil. And you see, there's a little bit, hopefully you can see, at the bottom there's a cute little picture of the Indians paying tribute to Hollandia, a personification, and they're saying, Venisti tandem, at last you've come. I also particularly appreciate the fishy decorations. It's a maritime history, but he's got shells, dolphins, and various other watery beasts there. And I'll show you very briefly this one. Well, we were just hearing about the Argenis of Berkeley. or Pellier-Fer's translation of the Argenis. Again, looking very much like a tomb. And to remind ourselves of what a tomb looks like, this is the tomb of the Doge Giovanni Pesaro in the Frari in Venice, 1669, designed under the direction of Baldessari Longhena, the architect. So the architect is thought to have done the overall design, but the individual statues are done by other people. There are four allegories of intelligence, nobility, wealth, and study, religion and constancy, truth and justice. We might note the abundance. So I realise now I'm pointing at the screen, of course, but you can't see where I'm pointing. The abundance of texts between them four Moors. And that is literally in the middle, at the bottom, that is literally a door. So these things imitate doors, sometimes they are really doors. And note the word play, the annominationes. Vixit, at bottom left, he lived 70 years. De Vixit, he unlived in 1659. I'm wondering if De Vixit is a real word, actually. I think it might be a bit invented. And then Revixit. In 1669. If in the title pages we see large buildings made small, in some cases we see small things that look very large. This is a reliquary of St. Alexius of 1691, which is 54 centimetres high. It looks like it should be 10 times bigger. In my view. Is it fanciful, I wonder, to see a similar quality in Gongora? Gongora is famous for his microscopic effects. And the passage here is where the pilgrim of the Solidarius is shipwrecked. He lays his clothes out on the strand to dry. And is it, y al sol le extiende luego, lamiéndole apenas su dulce lengua de templado fuego, lento lo embiste, y con suave estilo, la menor onda chupa al menor hilo. The frontal symmetrical frame proved extremely resilient, but there was a counter tendency to another decentered structure, which perhaps we might regard as typically Baroque. This is a 1634. And this, I don't have the date for handy, but you see that these have single, undivided compositions rather than the old compartmentalized title pages. And I see here a literary parallel in Calderón's El Pintor de su Deshonra. Broca, the painter of his dishonor, paints Hercules pursuing the centaur who has abducted his wife Deianira. And in this text, Hercules is so decentered, he's outside the picture. Right down at the end, in the text that's in bold. Fuera de la tabla está, y aún estuviera más fuera, si en la tabla no estuviera el centauro tras quien va. Again, I can't help but visualize that as a decentered Baroque painting. And I must be right, because Marc Fumaroli says the same thing. I'm not going to bother. We now come to what I think is one of the most important elements, allegory and personification. Although these terms are often elided, I think it's important to distinguish them, although I confess that I myself have been guilty of confusing them in the title of my paper, because most of these allegories are not allegories, they are personifications. Allegory can be both a way of reading and of writing, but I maintain that it was in the 17th century and in the Middle Ages a much more common way of reading. And the illustrative example is Dante's Convivio, where he says that when Ovid says Orpheus subdued the brute beasts with his song, this means the wise man with his speech moves men to his will. Isidore tells us that allegory says one thing and means another. What examples might we find in the literature, or indeed the arts of this period? Edmund Spenser, circa 1580, called his verse chivalric romance, The Faerie Queen, a continued allegory or dark conceit. But I think he was in the minority. Nobody nowadays believes in the allegorical purpose of Gongora's Solidaris, although there were certainly people in Gongora's time who thought they were an allegory. Allegory as a way of writing, I think what I've got here was limited. Let's say it was centered on emblems and fables. These fables are often associated with satire. In Spanish, that we have Cubillo de Aragon's two animal fables of 1623 and 1654. In England, Dryden in Absalom and Achitophel casts contemporary politicians as Old Testament figures. Now, it's not a very good picture here. Reminds us of a big controversy that used to be quite common in Dutch art history. I don't know if it still is. Did Dutch genre painters intend their pictures to be taken allegorically? The top slide shows a painting by Van Ostade of an alchemist, and an engraving by Jerome Koch after Peter Bruegel below, with a moralizing text in the bottom of it. And it was, I think this is a controversy of the 1970s and 80s. It may have been settled by now. Now, personification, the majority mode. Often these personifications are taken from manuals with a twist. The Carrasco's America on the right is easily recognizable from the textbooks, such as Cesare Ripa's iconography. Spain, I think, is a cross between fortitude and plenty. She's got a cornucopia, but she's also wearing armour and carrying a spear. And I think that's a combination of two images. In no way can these figures be said to say one thing and mean another. They are what they mean, and they mean what they are. The emblem, I think, is a true allegory. And emblems, we know, are utilized in these title pages. Well, bottom, left and right. Often when I look at these pictures, I immediately reach for Henkel and Schirner, who did the reference book on emblems. It's one of those books, never look at it on a Friday afternoon. You start reading it, and then 3 hours later, the afternoon has gone because one thing leads to another. It's all fascinating. If I had to go to a desert island with just one book, I would take Schirner. I'll just point out. No, I've gone off the topic here. I won't pause on these, partly because I have written about these title pages elsewhere, and I can give you the reference if you like. This, I think, is a nice example of really rather facile emblem making. You don't need to be a genius. Sorry, it's a book about dogs. You don't need to be a genius to use the emblem of a dog saying vigilanter et fideliter. Sometimes the title page depicts the literal contents of the book. It's very small. I don't know if it's visible. You probably can't see it there either. Right at the bottom, there's a scene identified by a quote from Juvenal that Sir Janus, when he fell from power, his portrait, his statue, his bust, was destroyed in a fire. And that's what he's commenting on. So that's the literal content of the book. Aldrovandi's book on monsters has got various little monsters depicted in bubbles. So an indication of what the book actually contains. Note also the pun on Sir Janus, Sir Janus, Eis Janus. Okay, I don't think you need to be a genius to work out that Sir Janus is an anagram of Eis Janus. But don't forget that puns are studied by people like Gratian in his work on wit. They were obviously highly regarded at the time. Sometimes these title pages have explanatory texts. And the best book on this is about English. Corbett and Lightbone wrote a book called The Comely Frontispiece in the 80s. And they show, well, they have about 20 English title pages of about which, I can't remember how many, several have explanations by the author. So if we were to turn the page, we would find a poem by the author explaining what all these images are. Although they make the interesting case that although Burton, the author, devised the iconography, he was not able to supervise the engraver, they say, who evidently worked on the basis of indications sent from Oxford, where Burton was. But there are discrepancies which showed that Burton never signed off the final image. Most of the books we've seen here have been substantial histories or scientific works, but it's interesting to note that the fashion for giving allegorical title pages also extended to more ephemeral publications such as theses or collections of annual sermons. These publications had small print runs. So we come to another paradox or another confluence that the imitation of monumentality is applied to a publication which is ephemeral. And you won't be surprised to learn that given the expense of these title pages, they were often reused. I do want to say something particular about sources because I think it's an understudied area. So here's Manuel de Fri Souza, 1666, has on the left the figure of Virtu, taken from Ripa, and on the right is a slightly ambiguous figure. Is it Minerva holding a tiny victory, or victory holding a tiny Minerva? The arms of Portugal are prominent. Very often it's the coat of arms of the patron. And at the bottom, a quote from Juvenal, bottom left and right, which is from the satires, but very likely taken from a reference book where it's catalogued under Nobilitas. So we have very strong indications of the use of two popular reference books, Cesare Ripa, Iconologia, 1593, alphabetically arranged, frequently illustrated, covered personifications and classical divinities. The Polyanthea of Mirabellius, Domenico Nani Mirabelli, was arranged by topics, first printed in 1503 and then in ever larger editions. We sometimes find biblical and classical quotations combined, and indeed they appear together in Mirabellius, so you didn't even need to look in a biblical concordance. And he also includes the texts of emblems. So who did what? The program was devised by the inventor, whose name appears with the verb invenit. The design was drawn by the draftsman, who signs De Lineavit. And then the drawing was reproduced on metal by the engraver, who signs Sculpsit. However, things in real life are hardly ever as simple. And the most common verb is fake it. How much did the authors of these books decide the content of the title page? We saw from Corbett and Lightbone that there are several examples of authorial involvement. There are others in various other countries. But at the risk of devaluing these title pages, this sort of erudition was not confined to major literary authors. There were erudite painters. It's instructive to look at the correspondence of the Dutch engraver De Witt to his publisher Van Buchel, 1604. It's a time of tremendous facility with Latin, that the French Académie des Inscriptions was founded in 1663. Its mission to compose Latin inscriptions for monuments. It's also the period of spontaneous anagrammatists. And I can quote George Sarton. In 1701, Ambrosius Nijpurkowitz of the Hermits of St. Paul published his Fragmenta, which contained upwards of 3,000 metrical anagrams on Luke 1:28. So this remarkable facility and fecundity for wordplay. And this collaboration is paralleled in other media. We saw very briefly with the case of that tomb in Venice, the collaboration between the architect and the sculptor. And now I'm coming near to the end. We have seen these eternal monumental images, Dixit Messa, paradoxically used for ephemera. Triumphal arches, which I haven't looked at, which stood for days, were made out of things like papier-mâché. Small run theses, vanity publishing, we would say, and Pentecost sermons. I've talked a bit about the confluence of the arts, and we will talk much more about the confluence of the arts, but I close with an image that combines text, image, and sound. This is John Bulwer's Philocopus, or The Deaf and Dumb Man's Friend, a work on sign language and how deaf and dumb people could be enabled to appreciate sound. And so here we see the great men of science. We see what I think at the very bottom must be literal examples of different types of hearing exemplified by different types of physiognomy. And you see a deaf man appreciating music through what the scientists call bone conduction in his teeth. We've seen the title page as a paper version of larger cultural objects made of concrete materials made small. Horace's dictum ut pictura poesis was a topic not always well understood It's often quoted by authors saying, your poetry is so vivid, it's like a painting. Well, that's not very profound. Many title pages may be unoriginal, and many may be stereotypes, but they demonstrate, and to a broad audience, word and image united in a single purpose. Thank you for listening.
Sembla que durant els 5 minuts acceptar preguntes, comentaris, no? 5 minuts màxim. Jo sí que tinc una pregunta. Sí. No hi ha cap altra persona. En anglès, ho faré en anglès. What do you mean by the frontispieces are syncretic?
Well, that they bring together word and image, largely in a single product. And to a degree, they mediate different local cultures which had in common a Latin, international Latin culture.
Do they also transmigrate?
Oh, they do. Yes, indeed, they do. Just like emblems, you get emblems written by Protestant Germans in Latin, which then appear in Spanish Catholic political treatises and that sort of thing.
Okay. Hi ha un altre comentari, observació? Sí. Més alta, sí, sisplau.
Yes, well, that's, well, yes, thank you for your question. Yes, it's certainly true. But of course, we have to remember what we often forget, that almost every book had a patron. We forget this sometimes. We think that poets lived in poverty and wrote what they had in their hearts. No, they didn't. They wanted patrons. And often they were used as diplomatic gifts and that sort of thing, precisely. And for political propaganda. So I think there's a definite continuation with medieval usage. Also, one thing I didn't bother to mention is that the emblems, which we think of as being so much a thing of print culture, do have a prehistory in illuminated manuscripts. So, no, I think you're absolutely right. Thank you.